Welcome to the Hockey Podcast for Friday, February 17. My name is Dennis Trina Jr. Today, I'm very happy to have welcome David DeGraw. Earlier this week on his website, ampstatus.org, David published the two-year anniversary report of the economic elite versus the people of the United States of America with updates that include some very personal history, a backstory that amounts to a very insider's look at the gestation and birth of the 99% movement. In the February 2010 document, begins with the following statement, quote, "It's time for the 99% of Americans to mobilize and aggressively move on common sense political reforms. It states early on, it's now become evident to a critical mass that Republican and Democratic parties, along with the three branches of government, have been bought off by a well-organized economic elite who are tactically destroying our ways of life. The harsh truth is that the 99% of the U.S. population no longer has political representation. The U.S. economy, government, and tax system are now blatantly rigged against us." Again, that is from February 2010, authored by David DeGraw on ampstatus.org. David, thank you very much for joining me today.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Dennis. It's always great to talk to you. I've really been an admirer and have a lot of respect for all the work you've done.
Appreciate it. So is this February 2010 report then the start of the 99% movement, the conception of it anyway?
Right. Well, it was the start of the 99% movement. Then, you know, once September 17 happened, it really evolved well past, you know, what we had originally conceived. So, you know, that's an interesting question. In the book, I basically say we should say that it started on September 17th. But, you know, on February 15th, 2010, that is when, you know, technically the 99% movement started.
Right. And a few days ago, you published this two-year anniversary report of that. And in the first section, titled Respect to Leaders and Support the Troops, you write the following incendiary, so you've got a fan in me, comment. You say, "Since this movement has taken off, many organizations that cover our actions and operate on the periphery of the movement are now receiving large donations and funding, partly as a result of our efforts. They also deserve to be rewarded for their vital work. However, people putting their bodies on the line daily and doing all the heavy lifting need to have their basic needs met as well. It's incredibly disheartening to see career activists that have failed for years to do what we have done fundraise off of our backs, while the real fighters and change makers go hungry." David, what career activists do you see fundraising off of Occupy Wall Street's back?
Well, I mean, I don't want to particularly name names because I don't think it's fair. You know, people who try to make change for a living, I have a lot of respect for them. But it is extraordinarily disheartening. You know, I've talked to Occupy Wall Street organizers all over the country and, you know, occupiers all over the country. And everyone is coming from, you know, obviously a very difficult financial place. And the heartbreaking stories of, you know, people needing places to stay, people needing medical care, you know, I mean, people are going to the hospital and they can't afford to pay the hospital bills, you know, people being arrested. And, you know, there are various bail funds to help people out. But still, you know, I mean, there's real ramifications to being on the front lines day in and day out. And they need financial support. We need financial support. And, you know, it is disheartening because, you know, this movement has really opened up, you know, a lot of, you know, eyes and a lot of funding sources that weren't there before. And, you know, everyone who's in independent media and has been, you know, a career activist is now, you know, in a position where they can tap into that funding. And, you know, I give those people a lot of respect. They've done a lot of great work to, you know, get us to this point. But, you know, it's just so disheartening to hear all these horror stories day in and day out from the people who are on the front lines, the people who are putting their bodies on the line, the people who are getting arrested, the people who have pushed this conversation onto the national agenda. These people are broke. They have nothing. So It's incredibly frustrating to have to hear from these people on a daily basis and know that there is some money being, you know, brought in, but it's not reaching the people who are on the front lines.
Well, is that for a failure of a mechanism of Occupy Wall Street to not collect money? I mean, money's been a problem at General Assemblies, Occupy Wall Street. Some people even talking about stopping taking donations altogether.
Right. Well, I mean, it is a decentralized movement, and you know, a lot of people have a lot of different views on funding. But mm-hmm. you know, from my personal experience, I can tell you, man. I mean, people severely need funding. I mean, the people have to live. They need to be able to eat and have, you know, shelter, medical care if they're going to keep, you know, coming out and, you know, battling on the front lines here. I mean, we need funds. And, you know, I mean, I think, you know, at least the people that I deal with, you know, because you can't really speak for the whole movement, it's so decentralized, but the people that I work with, you know, I mean, we all realize that we need to do a better job of bringing in some funding so, you know, people's basic necessities are met.
Well, I know you're too diplomatic to name names. I've taken a lot of flack for naming Van Jones's name. People are very upset with that the idea that I criticize someone who is on the surface very, very progressive, but yet as one of the core organizers of Stop the Machine, which was also known as October 2011, we reached out to Van Jones and were told flat out that we were too radical. And it wasn't until Occupy Wall Street made, you know, this whole thing sexy that Rebuild the Dream all of a sudden is sponsoring this big walk down to from Occupy Wall Street down to D.C. Is Rebuild the Dream and Van Jones one of those people, one of those organizations and people whose names you are too diplomatic to name?
Well, you could sir. I mean, the points you just laid out, you know, the whole Stop the Machine, and he wasn't very supportive of that. But, you know, in the very beginning, you know, I too was constantly told that, you know, my work is too radical, and, you know, we were doing all these bank protests in the run-up to September 17th, and, you know, organizations like MoveOn really, you know, they didn't help us at all. But, you know, since then, I mean, the way I look at it at the end of the day is, you know, we need as much help as we can get. You know, this needs to be an inclusive movement. You know, the 99% was all about finding whatever common ground you can find with people and working from that point. So, you know, I mean, now when I look at all those organizations that didn't want anything to do with us before September 17th, you know, I feel personally a little bitter about it, but looking at the overall movement perspective, I mean, we got to work with these people. We need all the help we can get. As far as I'm concerned, I mean, believe me, I understand, you know, the bitter past and then the lack of support we got during the run-up to September 17th. But, you know, overall, long-term, I think from a personal perspective, I want to put that behind us and I want to find ways where we can work together because we need all the help we can get, man.
Yeah. The shifting gears a little bit, the two-year anniversary that you just put out, this call to anniversary to the 99% call to action, it's filled with some personal stories about what you were personally going through while you were writing this report back in February of 2010.
Right.
Tell us in particular about your last night as a resident in New York City. As a New Yorker by birth and disposition myself, I can relate to the disappointment upon leaving the city. But yours has a particular kind of poetic resonance for the movement.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite, you know, a serendipitous story. But, you know, I actually live three blocks away from Zuccotti Park. And, I, you know, I was working in independent media for years. And when the financial crisis hit, a lot of funding sources dried up. So my ability to, you know, have a nice apartment, you know, a couple blocks from Wall Street and, you know, to be able to afford that really dried up fast. So I had to move out of Manhattan. And, you know, I used to always go to Zuccotti Park and, you know, I'd go there and just read a book, have some cup of coffee and hang out. And, you know, total serendipitous happenstance that we would end up coming back to that exact place because, you know, I was so frustrated. You know, I've been reporting on Wall Street and the Federal Reserve and the financial crisis. So, you know, I was sitting there at Zuccotti Park, you know, across from the Federal Reserve building and thinking about, you know, Wall Street, and I was just really depressed and, you know, kind of blame them for the lack of funding, not to pass the buck, you know, you got to take, you know, personal credit for your failures. But So, you know, I always just, you know, had it in for the New York Fed and you know, the stock exchange in general. So coming back there for, well, the first time we came back was June 14th when we had a failed occupation attempt. And
right.
then, you know, and the person who did the research, the legal research, and chose Zuccotti Park is actually a guy named Gary Rowland, which isn't even really his real name. I met him through an anonymous 99 message board that we had set up. And he was working in real estate development. He lost his job, and he did the legal research and picked Zuccotti Park as the place for our June 14th occupation attempt.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how that all came about. And it was just total serendipitous, you know, fate that was the park that was right around the corner from my house.
In a report you did last year, so splitting the difference between the Februarys, this is February 2011, entitled Analysis of the Global Insurrection Against Neoliberal Economic Domination and the Coming American Rebellion, We Are Egypt, Revolution Roundup Number 3. That's a mouthful. You said, if you think what's happening in Egypt won't happen within the U.S., you've been watching too much TV. The statistics speak for themselves. And yet, David, for all the Occupy movement success, is it accurate to say we have not leveraged enough power to enact any reforms yet? I mean, never mind a revolution. So, I mean, I hope one day, but
right.
do the comparisons to Egypt and Bahrain and Syria and other places like this help grow the Occupy's numbers, or do they make us seem too hyperbolic, too easy for the mainstream middle class to dismiss?
Well, that's a complicated question. I guess, you know, I think that what we've achieved is we've changed the national political discussion. We've raised awareness. You know, going into this, you know, people would mock us and say Americans are too propagandized and passive to do any kind of nonviolent civil disobedience, let alone have some kind of national movement based on it. So what's happened since September 17th is we prove that, you know, there are a lot of Americans who will come out and participate in nonviolent civil disobedience to fight back against, you know, what we call the organized criminal class, or, you know, 0.1% of the population. But, you know, so we've raised awareness and we've kind of like sparked this thing. But of course, we still have very, very far to go, and
mm-hmm.
we can't get there fast enough, as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, we got a long way to go still. There's no doubt.
You touched on this earlier, but the momentum building around the 99% movement had some critical early support, and continues to have support from Anonymous.
Right.
In your 2-year anniversary report, you talked about some denial of service attacks that were visited upon your website, AmpStatus.
Right.
Have you ever speculated about the source of those attacks?
You know, we never figured out exactly who it was. You know, with these attacks, they can come from all different remote servers around the world. So we at least weren't able to figure out who exactly it was. But, you know, at the time we were doing a lot of reporting on global protests. You know, we had set up these online, you know, social networking, independent online social networks where people could organize in, you know, secret kind of, you know. So there was a lot of different angles that these attacks could have come from. But I'm not exactly sure where they did come from. But as you said, several members of Anonymous, if you can call them members of Anonymous, it's you know, Anonymous is a difficult to explain concept, basically. But you know, there are some people who operate under the banner of Anonymous who have, you know, amazing skills. You know,
right.
So several of those members helped us out, and it was from that, getting help from them, that, you know, they got into the 99% movement. So then we formed this collaborative effort called A99, which is just, you know,
right,
like Anonymous 99. And that was when we first started calling for the occupation of Wall Street, and we did the June 14th thing.
Even before that, in March, A99 released a
right.
video demanding Bernanke step down as chair of the Fed. Have you heard from Ben?
No, I haven't heard from Ben at all. I would like to hear from Ben. I would love to have a debate or something with Ben Bernanke. That would be excellent. Because, you know, I look at Ben Bernanke as, you know, we called him the Mubarak of the global economy. I think he's guilty of crimes against humanity. His Fed policies have, you know, just been vicious. I mean, genocidal almost in their impact throughout the world. So, you know, I look at Ben Bernanke, you know, he's an interchangeable figurehead. You know, he's a puppet. Right. If Bernanke stepped down, I'm sure they'd find someone else to fill in. But still, you know, I mean, someone needs to be held responsible for tens of millions of people being driven into poverty. And you know, his deliberate policies, you know, led to spikes in food prices and oil prices and really kind of sparked this global movement, you know, in countries like Egypt and Tunisia that are on, like, the fringe of the neoliberal empire. You know, the little effects of policies and shifts in the dollar and food prices has a huge impact. And they knew that impact was going to be had.
Greed kills.
Yes, it does.
So you touched on this June 14th occupation in Zuccotti, Liberty. A lot of people don't know about that. In a press release about that event, this Gary Rowland that you mentioned earlier was quoted as saying that we're going to occupy the park indefinitely to express nonviolent dissent for the consolidation of wealth at the hands of international corporations by the corrupted two-part oligarchy. Sounds familiar, if only in hindsight. Tell us how that June 14th occupation went.
You know, it was amazing. You know, through Anonymous released two videos that got hundreds of thousands of views in the run-up to the June 14th event. And we were able to get a lot of media coverage. And, you know, so online and throughout the media, I was really impressed by the amount of coverage and attention we got. But when it actually came to moving, you know, offline, you know, we had a small turnout. I think there was only about 16 people who wanted to occupy the park that day. It was a joke. You know, given hundreds of thousands of people engaged online, and to have such a small turnout offline was just completely disheartening. But what turned out to be another amazing serendipitous thing was that very same day is when they set up Bloombergville, which was right, you know, down the road by City Hall. And the fact that we had a weak turnout and then some of us could go over to Bloombergville and then, you know, start working with those guys to, you know, come back again on September 17th really turned out to be a blessing in disguise.
Do I have my history right that out of this pair, the 899 group and the Bloombergville group, that the New York City General Assembly, which actually predates the occupation of Liberty Park, is this how this comes to pass?
Right. Well, they were experimenting in Bloombergville with various assemblies. You know, then they started calling it the People's General Assembly. So it really grew out of the Bloombergville protests. And, you know, they were basically copying what was happening in different occupations throughout the world.
I was pleased to see you credit among the many, many, many reasons why this movement came into being the Stop the Machine or October 2011 coalition, of which I was a core organizer. Many don't know, rightfully, because it's become just one chapter in a very large movement, but the October 2011 coalition made this call before Adbusters made the call for Occupy Wall Street for an indefinite occupation in D.C.
Right.
I'm going to get to that in a second. I remember being in New York on September 21st, just 4 days into Occupy Wall Street, and thinking that I hope that you guys don't burn yourselves out because you got to save some energy to come to D.C.
Right, exactly.
I mean, your thinking, for me at that time, was the New York Police Department was going to route you guys out, and then we all come and assemble down in D.C. The movement's become much bigger than just Occupy Wall Street or Stop the Machine. It's something truly decentralized. But in your opinion, does the country need a massive display of power or sustained occupation in the nation's capital?
Well, it certainly would help. You know, I know you, are you involved in planning the March 30th occupation, the NOW occupation?
A little bit, yes.
Right. Yeah, you know, I mean, as many people as we can get out in D.C. is strategically, you know, very important. You know, you mentioned the whole Stop the Machine and the planning of that. You know, when you guys, you know, Kevin Zeese, Margaret Flowers, and the whole coalition that you guys built, that I think that played a big role in making September 17th successful because, I mean, you guys were really building momentum and had, you know, this great online campaign, video campaign where people were talking about going to D.C. to set up occupation. And, you know, you really helped kind of plant the seeds for a successful September 17th occupation. And I remember, you know, when the September 17th thing happened, you know, none of us were really sure it was going to take off, that's for sure. And but, you know, when things started to go well and we were a few days in, I remember thinking like, oh, man, if we can just keep this going until the D.C. occupation starts and then people can shift down there, like maybe we can really break through the mainstream. And then, you know, as it turned out, I thought our big last day of action in New York was going to be September 24th because that was a Saturday, and I felt like the momentum through the week was starting to dissipate a little bit. So I thought our last big day of action would be Saturday the 24th, you know, 1 week in, and that is when, you know, Tony Bologna decided to pepper spray those girls in the face. And then once that happened, I mean, it just totally blew up. And then the weekend after that, we had the Brooklyn Bridge incident, and then, you know, you guys started up, occupation started everywhere, and I mean, the rest is history, right?
Yeah, absolutely. A couple more questions. I personally entered the movement through the angle of the anti-war peace movement,
right?
Which I've been active in. It's been, you know, it's been my contention for a long time that more than any specific war that anyone can stand against, it's U.S. foreign policy for the past 70 years. It's been a, you know, it's been a blowback-inducing bull in a geopolitical China shop. It's also been my experience that the Occupy movement, while not really rejecting anti-war marches or actions, has kind of held the peace movement at something of an arm's length. Do you have any insight as to why that might be? Does that resonate with you as well?
You know, I mean, I guess you can say that to a certain extent. It's so hard to say, Dennis, because, I mean, like, who, you know, what is the Occupy movement? I mean, it's so decentralized. Mm-hmm. People have so many different opinions. You know, I talk to people throughout the country, and, you know, everyone is unified, you know, against the consolidation of wealth, I guess you can say. But their opinions are all over the map, you know. I mean, everyone's against the concentration of power and the rigged political system. But, you know, within that, you have so many different particular issues and viewpoints that, you know, ebb and flow. Certainly, you know, I look at, you know, the anti-war movement and, you know, I look at military spending and, you know, right. That's a huge, huge problem. I mean, you know, even under Obama, he's increased the amount of private military contractors. Private military contractors make, you know, five times as much as civilian contractors. And, you know, the war on terror is, I mean, it's a racket. It's a complete war profiteer racket. Mm-hmm. And it's disgusting. And, you know, I mean, I'm all for, you know, stopping the war racket. That's for damn sure.
You and I have talked before about what I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is becoming your top focus that hopefully would solve all these problems. That's getting money out of politics. Does Move to Amend go far enough in that direction? The language of their amendment seems like it has a few vague windows. It says federal, state, and local government shall regulate, limit, or prohibit contributions and expenditures, et cetera. Why give them the option to regulate a limit? Why not simply prohibit money and have publicly financed elections?
Right. Well, you know, it's a complicated subject, and, you know, I certainly lean towards just having complete publicly financed elections. But, you know, the bottom line is whatever your issue is, whether it's the war, the, you know, economy, or, you know, household debt, school debt, health care. I mean, pick an issue, and if you get to the root problem, it's because, you know, people who have power have the most money, and they're able to buy politicians, they're able to buy legislation. You know, we call in you know, the 99% movement in the year and a half before Occupy Wall Street, we had this thing called the system of political bribery that we focused on, which was campaign finance, lobbying, and the revolving door between, you know, Washington and the biggest global corporations. And, you know, we were constantly, you know, before Adbusters changed the frame, you know, our demand was always ending the system of political bribery, because that was where we could find the 99% common ground, and we could unite on that, because people from across the political spectrum see how, you know, big money interests just completely dominate our political process. And then whatever issue it is, you know, you get the problems. You have this incredible concentration of wealth and power because we have a rigged, bought government.
And Move to Amend, you think, strikes a blow, strong enough blow in that direction?
I don't know if it's strong enough. You know, I get very upset when people start talking about, you know, overturning Citizens United. Overturning Citizens United is definitely an important step, but, you know, when people talk about that, I think they've gone to the Obama School of Negotiation. You know, I mean, Citizens United was only 2 years ago. The system was, you know, bought well before 2 years ago. So overturning Citizens United is a step in the right direction, but that is definitely not the bar we need to set.
Final question, David. As you look to the near future, is there a single Occupy-related activity or event that gets you most excited?
In the near future, you know, that people don't really grasp how much is really happening throughout the country. It's frustrating to me that we don't have better coordination. Things like InterOccupy really excite me because it's a communication system that's you know uniting the people throughout the country that are working in the movement. So you know, as of right now, things like InterOccupy and these coordination efforts, even though it's a decentralized movement, we can still be better coordinated, and we can still do a better job of highlighting all the incredible work that's happening. You know, before September 17th, there was only a handful of things happening, but since September 17th, we went from 5 miles an hour to 150 miles an hour, and there's things happening all over the place that really aren't being covered, and if more people could find out about it, you know, that we would get bigger turnouts at all these different events that are happening. But, you know, certainly the March 30th occupation of D.C. I think is going to be, you know, incredible. And then moving to Chicago in May,
A lot of people have that on their – a lot of people have Chicago on their calendar. I think that's going to be really big.
Yeah, I think Chicago is going to be huge, you know, with all the action going on there through the month of May. So, yeah, the occupation of D.C., end of March, and then May in Chicago are going to be huge.
All right. Thank you, David. That's all the time I have today. My guest was David DeGraw of AmpStatus.com and Occupy Wall Street. This has been OccuPodcast. Follow us at OccuPodcast.org and at Twitter at OccuPodcaster.